Greetings to each and all, you who live in the world today and in the time to come. This is John Lash, recording on Sunday, the 12th of January, 2014. The title of this recorded lecture is Celestics, Introduction to Forensic Astronomy. Although the title may sound somewhat esoteric, or perhaps even a little forbidding, I ask you to consider that I am presenting some fundamental or elementary and introductory material regarding astronomy and astrology and divination of the sky by methods which I have developed over 5 decades of my life. Now, this talk is an introduction, as the title indicates. So, it ought to be user-friendly and generally accessible to anyone who has an interest in the subjects so named. Well, I would also point out that this introduction would be the lead-in to a series of talks and hopefully interviews, student-teacher interviews or Q&As to be done in the near future. It's my intention to produce this material in the year 2014. I'm doing so out of a deep compulsion in myself, which has been operating for many years and nagging me a bit. To put it fast and simple, since I wrote Quest for the Zodiac in the year 2000, which is now going on 14 years ago, half a cycle of Saturn, I felt that my work was certainly not yet completed. I have the intention to teach and transmit as much as possible of the astrology and forensic astronomy that I have developed in my life. And so this introduction is the first step with the initiative of teaching and transmitting that body of knowledge and that methodology. I'm grateful for your attention and for your patience. I have not made a set of notes. I am giving this lecture completely off the top of my head. I have not organized the presentation. I have not written down a set of points or topics to develop systematically. But truth be told, I guess I could say that there is no other subject in my field of knowledge, which is diverse, as you know, and reaches into various genres, there's no other subject that is so innate to me. I really have it under my skin. And so I feel confident that the way to present it to you now in this talk, to present it to the world of today and the future, is to just jam it the way that jazz musicians get together and they jam. You know, improvisational jazz is a paradigm that I've used to teach down through the ages. So what I'm doing now is giving a solo performance. You can imagine me on a sax or maybe on a bass fiddle. And my intention is that I don't merely play solo all the way through, but you join in and you learn to play with me. So we'll be jamming on forensic astronomy and astrology starting now. I know that people are uncomfortable with these subjects, particularly astronomy. I learned many years ago when I was teaching in Santa Fe that there is a block, a resistance, in the way of absorbing astronomical material. And as far as astrology goes, well, I can assure you that it is extremely complicated and technical. So let's see if my solo skills can lure you to get the beat, to start tapping your foot, humming some of the lyrics, maybe singing some of the lyrics as they arise. I have waited a long time to initiate talks on astrology and astronomy in this manner. I have had huge reticence against doing so. But I'm certain that the time is ripe now. I just want you all to understand going in that it's not an ordinary class situation, as you hear my words. It's an invitation to jam with me, to pick up the terms, the jargon, and there is a lot of jargon involved, and to pick up the technical formulas and the formats of which astronomy and astrology are comprised. And it is my wish and my intention that you learn fast and easy and become comfortable with all of these components and enjoy using them, enjoy jamming with them, talking about them amongst yourselves, and discussing them with me as this interactive class experiment proceeds. Now, in the field we're entering, nomenclature is tremendously important. Astronomy has its nomenclature. Consider, for instance, these words: ecliptic, planetary nodes, the lunar apogee, the lunar perigee, precession of the equinoxes, declination, elongation from the sun. These are parts of the nomenclature of astronomy, and they belong both to the mathematics and calculations of astronomy as well as to visual astronomy, that is to say, naked eye observation of the sky. By the way, I should point out a limit and qualification of my work in this field. I have always taught naked eye astronomy. You do not need any instruments, such as a telescope, to follow this method, nor do you need any instruments to observe the sky. Although you may, if you choose, use wide-field binoculars in order to study the composite stars of a constellation. In that way, you can get a better view, a better grasp of what constitutes the form of the constellation in the sky. And there you go, another piece of nomenclature from astronomy: constellation. Do you know what a constellation is? Well, by the end of this little jam session, I would suspect that you could talk about constellations and use the term with confidence and enjoyment. So let's see if my suspicions play out. Now, back to the problem of nomenclature. There are perhaps, 20, 25 key terms in the nomenclature or jargon of astronomy that you would need to learn. Turn to astrology and there are, at minimum, 50 terms in the nomenclature of astrology. Astrology is tremendously technical and complicated. The components of the horoscope are gruesomely complex. I assure you that in these lessons and in the ongoing presentation that I am beginning today, that you will not be subjected to the massive and daunting technicalities of astrology. I'm making it clear at the outset that the purpose of these talks is not to teach astrology. If I were to teach you astrology, that is to say, to pass on to you the kind of astrology that I developed in my career, I would have to dedicate an entirely different set of talks to that objective. Let's set that aside for the moment. I would prefer not to do that. If I am to teach any of the astrological method that I developed, which I at once called Terrastrology, which I have also called Starbase, then I would prefer to do so person to person and in a flesh and blood classroom situation. So that's a prospect of the future, and it would be wonderful and lovely for everyone on the planet if that came to pass. But right now I'm here alone in Spain in my navigator's booth on the second floor of my little rented house. And I'm beginning this introduction with a focal term. What I am going to present to you is so massive that I would like to focalize your mind on a term, a new piece of nomenclature, a fresh term. And I would like to put that term in your minds as the label that covers and encompasses everything that I am now going to impart. So that term, of course, is celestics, C-E-L-E-S-T-I-C-S. Now, I think some of you may note, happily, that it rhymes with telestics. And indeed, celestics is an aspect of telestics. What is telestics? Well, telestics is a word that I coined on metahistory.org some time ago, I guess perhaps around the year 2008, 2009. Telestics is a word derived from the Greek telos, T-E-L-O-S, meaning aim, objective, purpose, goal. The word teleology, which is a common English word, refers to the study or science of goals or objectives, teleology. Scientists say that a process is teleological if it can be shown to unfold in a manner that reveals a systematic and deliberate pursuit of an objective or aim. For instance, the activity of bees flying around, pollinating plants and flying back and forth across the sky is teleological or teleological because if you observe the behavior of bees, you can see that it has an object, which is to bring the pollen back to the hive where honey is made and where the queen bee, the life of the queen bee, is maintained. So the activity of bees is teleological. Nature on the planet Earth is largely teleological. My particular slant on the word telestics, of course, comes from Gnostic studies. In the Gnostic writings found in the Nag Hammadi codices, you find the word telos or variations of that word, particularly the adjectival form, that is to say, telos the noun presented as an adjective, which I believe is teleis, T-E-L-E-I-S, or variations like that. Unfortunately, scholars have translated this word, this adjective derived from telos, to mean perfection. It doesn't mean perfection at all. It means that which has achieved its objective. But that is not perfection. There is no perfect objective. So I would translate the adjective forms of telos as accomplished, having reached its goal, achieved, accomplished, having attained its predetermined goal. I think you get the drift. After considering these variations for a long time, years in fact, I concluded that the best single word to translate the adjective form of telos is ultimate. Your life, for instance, has an ultimate purpose. And so the word telestic refers to the ultimate purpose of something. Telestics is therefore the science of not only identifying, but achieving the ultimate purpose of dot, dot, dot. Specifically, looking back at the ancient mysteries, from which we today draw the Sophianic message to humanity, we find that those mysteries were founded and directed by human beings who called themselves Telestai, T-E-L-E-S-T-A-I. We who are aimed, we who pursue an ultimate purpose, we who know the ultimate purpose and are in the process of accomplishing it. A powerful word. The singular form is telestes, T-E-L-E-S-T-E-S. So I am making a slight digression here into the realm of Gnosticism and the Sophianic message in order to orient you to the word celestic, because celestic is really an application of the word it rhymes with. Celestics, considered as an art and a science and a method, is the pursuit of ultimate goals, particularly the ultimate goal of human life on earth and each individual life. It is the pursuit of those ultimate goals using the intel, if you will, provided by the sky. Just imagine. If we are, let's say, assuming the role of modern-day telestai, like the teachers of the ancient mysteries, then we are investigating the ultimate purpose of things. We are investigating even the teleological nature of the consciousness of the planet itself. What are the designs and purposes of the living planet itself? This is the great telestic / Gnostic investigation, which now recommences at the Gnostic moment, which began in the year 2013. In this telestic investigation, acting like artists and scientists, we require certain tools. Artists require tools, the paintbrush, the canvas. If you're a drafting artist, you require compasses, various devices that go on your drafting table, rulers and other tools of that sort. And scientists also, obviously, use a vast variety of tools. In the great, great framework of telestics, there is a specific field of celestics, which uses the sky, the stars, the formations of the starry constellations, the planets, the sun, the moon, the earth, all of the components of the solar system, and all of the physical, geophysical, and astronomical elements operating in that system, and all of the encompassing elements beyond that system, going right to the galactic core to investigate human and transhuman purposes. And that is your Mission Impossible if you wish to accept it. But this tape does not self-destruct in 10 seconds. Thus, I have the opportunity to elaborate a little further on this mission that I am outlining. So, let's go now from telestics, which is the great background concept, to celestics. This is a new word. Now, I checked on the internet to see if this word is in use. It appears to be that there is an electronic band called the Celestics. And maybe they have trademarked that name. I don't want to wander onto anyone's turf. But I'm not talking about the Celestics. I'm just using the word Celestics as a noun and Celestic as an adjective. So I don't think there should be a intellectual property rights problem here. I will point out, however, on that note, that I do claim the intellectual property rights to certain terms that are now going to come up frequently in these lessons on astronomy and astrology. I do claim provenance for the term stellar zodiac, real sky zodiac, and starbase. And I hold the appearance of my book, Quest for the Zodiac, which was actually published, I think, in 1999, as proof of provenance, proof that those terms originate with me and that I use them in a way unique and incomparable, which cannot be confused with the way that anyone else is using them unless they follow my usage. Is that clear? So let's say now that I'm laying claim to the word celestics, which is a noun, and the adjective celestic. And I am also laying claim to the term forensic astronomy, which I have used in one of my navigator briefings in the course of 2013. So I advise those in the future to regard this recording as the register of my claim that celestics originates with me. But what is the origin of the word celestics itself? Well, obviously, it relates to the more common term celestial. Everyone knows that term. The dictionary says celestial means, it's an adjective, it means of or relating to the sky or the heavens, of or relating to heaven, that which is divine, or possibly supremely good or sublime, as in celestial happiness, celestial bliss. And used as a noun, celestial can mean a heavenly or divine being, a god or angel. So celestial is vastly used term, a widely known term. It derives via Middle English from the Old French, which in turn derives from the Latin celestialis, from Latin caelestis, from caelum, sky. C-A-E-L-U-M. Would that be caelum or caelum? I don't know. My Latin pronunciation has become a little rusty since I took a year of Latin in high school way back when I was 16. So, I'm introducing this term, celestics, as a focus for your attention now, and also perhaps as a way to relieve you of the burden and the intimidation and resistance that often arises at the very mention of the word astronomy or astrology. So what you're going to be learning now is the celestic art and method of investigating the designs and purposes of human life, of human behavior, and even the designs and purposes of the earth itself and of those divine beings who have been identified by Gnostics as the aeons of the Pleroma or galactic center. Now, I've been playing solo so far, but I'd like to see if you would just jam in with me for a moment. Just strum a few chords on your guitar or a few bars on the piano and jam right in and join right in with me, because what I want to do right now is lay a term on you and see if you can adopt that term and own it at the very moment that I reveal it. So let's say that I am you, and you want to say what's happening to you now as you're listening to John Lesch give this unique and groundbreaking talk. What's happening to you? Well, you answer in this way. I'm beginning to study celestics. I've just been introduced to celestics, and now I'm all set to learn what celestics is, and if I like it, and if I would enjoy it, I'm going to see if I can practice it. Those are the words that I'm putting into your mouths and into your minds, which are easy enough to say. Now, purely for the delight of doing so, I'm going to pronounce a word that has never been said before. It has never been used before. And with this novelty and the delight of being present at the origination of this word, I want you to feel that you're a part of this study and that it can be yours and you can enjoy it and be comfortable and confident with it and get over any blocks that may previously have arisen in regard to these topics, astrology, astronomy, study of the sky, study of the planetary system, and all that it entails. So again, I put myself in your skin, and I speak like this. Well, yeah, I'm looking into celestics now, and my objective is to learn the method so that I can become a celestician. Now, there's a word that has never been said before. Celestician. C-E-L-E-S-T-I-C-I-A-N. You notice how it rhymes with technician. Like if someone asks you, hey, what are you doing in life? Oh, I'm at school and I'm studying to become a dental technician or an IT technician. Okay? So, what is a celestician? It's a technician in the art of celestics. Happily, the word celestician rhymes with the word dialectician. Dialectician is a term intimately connected in its provenance with the figure of the Greek philosopher Socrates. In fact, Socrates called himself a dialectician to distinguish himself from the sophists who were rhetoricians. That is to say, they practiced rhetoric. But Socrates practiced dialectic. I'll come back to this distinction at the end of this talk because it is a tremendously important distinction in understanding at the outset how you are going to handle the intel and the formats of the celestic sciences. Now, what are the celestic sciences? What are the genres of celestics? Well, there are three of them. The first is astronomy. The word astronomy is composed of two parts, astro, meaning star, and nomos, meaning name, hence the naming of the stars. The next genre of celestics is astrology, composed likewise of astro, meaning star, and logos, meaning the science or language. So astrology means the science or language of the stars. Astronomy means the nomenclature, the naming and plotting and defining and calculating and data compiling of the stars. And then there is a third genre, which can be called divination. But it could as well be called astrology, A-S-T-R-O-L-E-G-Y, not L-O-G-Y, astrology. What is astrology, not astrology? Well, it consists of the word astro again, and a word derived from the Latin legere, meaning to read. And so astrology is reading the sky, which formerly was called divination. To read the sky as a language is an act of divination. There is vast evidence of the practice of this act or art in many cultures through the centuries. Divination of the celestial code, if you will, is the third genre of celestics, which may also be called astrology or the astrological aspect of celestics. Astrological, astrological, and astronomical. These are the adjectives we use. This is the totality of the jargon or terminology, to use the more polite word, required for your initial orientation to celestics. So, I'm studying to be a celestician, and I'm learning about the three genres of celestics. If you can say that, then you're in the jam. So, what is the key initial opening point in this study? What is the single primary factor that you need to know to be taken directly into the heart of this study? And as soon as possible, to enjoy what you know and to feel comfortable with the knowledge and the terms. I can tell you up front that there is a scandal on this planet regarding the subject of astrology, and that is probably the entry point that best suits this current introduction. Right now, at the half-hour point going into this talk, I can see that my second talk should be dedicated to my book, Quest for the Zodiac. And in that talk, I can explain how I came to write the book and what I am setting forth in that book. But for right now, I'll read from the back cover of Quest for the Zodiac, when it says, first of all, there's a quotation from Chapter 2, which is titled Signs of Delusion. The quotation is, "The aim of this book is not to convert anyone to astrology. The aim is to convert astrology itself." End quote. There follows the short paragraph of copy. It goes like this. Totally unsuspected by the world at large, astrologers use a model that ignores the stars. This means there is a lost star-based zodiac behind the well-known circle of 12 sun signs. Astrology is not wrong on its own terms, but it is wrongly defined as the language or science of the stars. Quest for the Zodiac corrects this bias and recovers the real sky environment observed by the ancients. The mythic images of the constellations, not the signs, reveal a new dimension of destiny. Here is the breakthrough that initiates a cosmic language for the 21st century. End quote. Well, such were my pretenses in 1999 and 2000 when I launched Quest for the Zodiac into the world. The place to start now, the exact place to start jamming, is the place that I defined in Quest for the Zodiac. That place, that entry point, concerns the difference between signs and constellations. This is where you begin. This is where you take on the terminology, but only if you are comfortable with it and you can repeat it out of your own mind and out of your own thinking. It is absolutely imperative to me as a teacher to stress this point. I'm going to tell you now about the difference between signs and constellations. Believe it or not, most practicing astrologers in the world are completely ignorant and oblivious to what I'm going to tell you now. It is a scandal, but this is the fact. But as I tell you this, the first time, I want it to register so that it becomes your own material. I want to give it to you in such a way that you do not merely repeat what the teacher said, but you can speak of it out of your own confidence of knowing. So here goes. I'm sitting here in my navigator booth in my little room, and I have a series of desks around me. I have desks in the other room upstairs and desks in the outside terrace downstairs. I need a lot of desks. I need a lot of layout space to do what I do. In fact, I could use a warehouse-sized room with 8 tables on it for layout space. But right now, in the modest facilities available to me, I have some layout space on the table beside my computer. Let me describe to you what is on this layout space. I've covered part of the desk with a dark material of a comforter in order to give a dark background. There is an open book here showing the line drawings of Austrian artist Gustav Klimt. And I have opened it to the drawing number 69, done in 1913, of two girls. So this is two models in Klimt's studio back there in 1913, a little over a century ago. And they are embracing each other, and they have their eyes closed, and they're in a dreamy and relaxed state. So there is the line drawing of Klimt, which anyone could study, anyone could enjoy in riffling through this wonderful art book, which is called 100 Drawings of Gustav Klimt, and it's published by Dover Publications. Now what I've done is I've taken a circular ruler and I've laid it down on the drawing. I've also photographed this. And so, if I manage to include the photograph with this MP3 file, you can look at it for yourself and see what I've done. I have a circular ruler, which is marked from 0 all the way around to 360. It has 360 marks on it, and it's divided in sections of 10, 20, 30, 40. So it is a dial. It is a calibrated dial. A plastic circular ruler. And I've laid it down over the line drawing. Now, suppose first that the circular dial wasn't there, and I wanted to describe to you some detail in the line drawing. Suppose I wanted to describe or indicate the fingers of the right hand of the girl in front. The fingers of the right hand of the girl in front. Or suppose I wanted to indicate the left nostril of the girl behind. Well, these are graphic details of Klimt's line drawing, and there are many. There's the hand of the girl behind, the hand of the girl in front, the left hand of the girl behind, as well as her right hand. There is the line of the hip of the girl in front. There is the line of her thigh. And there is the place where the line drawing indicates her knee. And there is also the navel of the girl behind. Well, these are all graphic details of Klimt's drawing. And if we were standing here admiring and discussing this drawing, I could say to you, well, look at the way that he's drawn the lips of the girl in front. Now, what's the difference when I put this circular ruler, when I lay down this circular ruler on the line drawing, how does that change the way that you and I could discuss what's in the drawing? Well, it doesn't change any of the details of the drawing at all. It doesn't change any of the graphic composition, but it puts the graphic composition into a grid reference. With a circular ruler laid down in that manner, we can locate the graphic details of Klimt's composition according to points on the ruler, that is to say, on the circular grid divided into 360 points, 360 marks. So, for instance, I can see that the 20th mark on the grid actually touches or coincides with a finger on the right hand of the girl behind. The right hand of the girl behind and the right arm embraces the head of the girl in front. And so the hand of the girl behind comes around the other girl's head and lays down slightly upon her collarbone. And Klimt has drawn the fingers. I could even say that I can identify the thumb of the right hand of the girl behind as corresponding on the circular dial to a distance from the 20th mark to the 23rd mark. Get the picture? Now, looking at the layover of the circular grid to the line drawing, I ask you to notice that there are two clearly different relationships between the grid and the graphics. There are places on Klimt's composition of these two girls, which is a line drawing, where the edge of the grid actually touches the details of the composition. For instance, there is a point which is about 65 on the circular grid, which touches the line of the top of the right thigh of the girl in front. So in that case, the graphic detail, the line describing her thigh, actually lies upon the edge of the dial. It lies upon the edge of the circular ruler. But there are many other graphic details in the Klimt line drawing that are either above or below, that is, outside or inside the edge of the circular dial. For instance, there is the elbow of the girl in front is removed above or outside, if you will, from the actual line of the circular ruler, unlike the line of her thigh, which crosses the edge of the circular ruler. See the difference? So the user-friendly term here that applies to the layover of the circular grid upon the graphics is rim. The circular ruler has a rim. And some of the details of this drawing lie on the rim. Clear enough? And some details lie off the rim, either outward from the center of the circle or inward toward the center. The user-friendly terminology here goes like this. Those details of the graphic drawing that lie on the rim are called rim-sighted. Rim-sighted. The word sight means location. So, Rim-sighted means located on the rim. And those that are not located on the rim are peripheral. That is to say, they are in the peripheral or outlying or inlying regions of the circular grid. Simple enough. So, what is a rim-sighted detail of this layout? Well, it appears that the pinky of the right hand of the girl in front is rim-sighted to the 28th mark on the grid. Without the grid, I can bring your attention to the pinky of the girl in front of her right hand, the small finger of her right hand, and I can say, look, how wonderfully, such agility and such finesse here. Look at the way that Klimt has drawn the little finger on the right hand of the girl in front. But if I want to bring your attention to that same detail using the device of the grid, I just say, go to mark 28. If I want to bring your attention to the thigh, the upper part of the right thigh of the girl in front, I say, go to mark 65. If your eyes go to mark 65, it immediately brings your view, brings your observation, directs your observation to that precise point in the graphic composition. Can you jam with that? Some details are rim-sighted, others are peripheral, and may be either above the rim or below it, or outside of the rim or within the rim. And that's the totality of initial language you need, initial syntax, in order to understand the relation between signs and constellations. Signs are simply divisions of the circular dial. The circular dial has 360 degrees that can be divided into 12 30-degree sections. The signs are starless, and they can be regarded as having no reference whatsoever to the environment of the starry sky. Just as I can pick up this circular ruler and hold it up against a blank wall, it has absolutely no reference to the graphic composition of the two girls by Klimt. I can use the grid, the circular grid, with its 360 marks, completely without reference to the graphics, that is to say, the observable picture you see in the overlay. So just take a moment to register that point and make it clear to yourself that the dial and the drawing are totally independent of each other, although they can be considered by a juxtaposition, that is to say, the overlay of the circular grid upon the graphic composition. So, to put it in IT jargon, what you're looking at here are two different formats. There is a circular numerical format, a geometrical format, if you will, a circle of 360 marks or degrees. And then, juxtaposed to that, there is a graphic format, a drawing, a picture. Obviously, the graphic composition of these two girls does not correspond to any geometrical pattern or structure of any kind. It's a free-form drawing made from observing live models in a studio in Vienna in 1913. Now, there's only about 10 minutes left in this introductory talk, so I'm not going to devote any time to discussing the historical background of these two formats or how they relate to the development of what we know as astrology today. I will reserve that exposition for my talk on Quest for the Zodiac, which immediately follows this one. I do want to point out one more detail in the layover of the circular grid and the graphics of Klimt's drawing. Remember that some details of his drawing are rim-sighted. You know what this means now, and you can say it yourself. Try it out. Speak it out. Say the rim-sighted aspects of Klimt's drawing are those which... dot, dot, dot. There are some features of the composition that are not on the rim. We call those peripheral. But even though they're not on the rim, they can still be located with respect to the rim as a locating device. If I lay a ruler across the circular dial and I make sure that the ruler lies right along the center of the dial, then I can move the ruler across the drawing so that the edge of the ruler touches certain parts of the drawing. And I've done that and photographed how that looks. Take, for instance, the left cheekbone of the girl behind. If we're discussing Klimt's drawing purely for aesthetic purposes and for the enjoyment of his art and his expertise, I can say, whoa, notice, look here at the way that he's drawn the left cheekbone of the girl behind. Well, that's one way to bring your attention to the graphic. But if I'm using the circular grid as a referent, I can say, look at degree 357. You see, there's the zero mark on the grid, and it goes all the way around to 360. So counting backward from the zero mark, you have 359, 358, 357. I have aligned a ruler from the center of the grid out past the rim of the grid, the measuring grid, to the cheekbone of the girl behind, the left cheekbone. And so if I want to bring your attention to that graphic detail without describing it at length, I just say, look at degree 357, which is 27 degrees of the sign Pisces in astrological language. Obviously, the degree is just a location device or measuring device that refers outwardly to another format. But that measuring device can be dissociated and removed from that format and treated as a format completely sufficient unto itself. This is what astrologers do when they use the circle of the 12 astrological signs without reference to the actual stars and constellations which are in the sky. Hence the difference between signs and constellations, and the terrible scandal of astrology, which should not be called astrology, because in fact, the terrible dark secret of astrology is that it ignores the actual stars. And it uses a starless circular grid as a tool for formatting a vast body of information regarding the behavior and attitudes and styles and complexes of human animals. Okay. Now to conclude this introductory talk, I'd like to ask you to go through a small exercise with me. I'm not going to illustrate this with photographs, although maybe I might. Anyway, just treat it as a guided visualization. Let's say that you're standing beside me here in my studio, and we're looking down at this lovely line drawing by Klimt. And I say to you, now lean over the table with me and watch what I'm going to do. I take a piece of tracing paper, and I lay it down over the image of the two girls. And then at various points on that image, say the nipple on the left breast of the girl behind, or her belly button, let's say the right eye of the girl in front, or the tip of her nose, or the left nostril of the girl behind, which is indicated by just a dot, and some places on the haunches of the girl in front, a point on her elbow. And I mark these points on a piece of tracing paper with various dots. Let's say that I make some of those dots large, some of those dots of a medium size, and some of those dots small. Now I take the piece of tracing paper off the drawing and I close the book. And what do you see? You see a piece of tracing paper with dots on it. But do you see a pattern of dots? Do those dots make any kind of pattern? Well, if you look at it for a while, your eyes may automatically see a pattern. Why is that? Because your eyes will automatically connect certain relationships between the dots, particularly between the larger dots. So, as we contemplate this arrangement of dots on the tracing paper, let's say that after a while we agree, yeah, this dot here and this dot here and this dot here make a kind of trapezoid, don't they? So we draw lines to connect them, and there's a trapezoid. But coming off that trapezoid, well, there's another line that goes down here, and we make a pattern from the patternless array of dots. This pattern can be called the signature of the composition of dots. So we have the composite of dots and the signature of that composite. That is to say, the dot-to-dot pattern that suggests itself to your mind as you look at the composite. The composite itself is nothing but the arrangement. It's not even an arrangement, excuse me. It's nothing but the totality of the dots that I drew on a piece of tracing paper. That's a composite. By adding the lines and connecting certain dots, we give the composite a definition, which is called the signature of the composite. Then the third step would be what? Well, suppose that we didn't know what was the basis of those dots, because the drawing of the two girls is no longer in front of us, right? I've closed the book. Even though the positions of those dots, large, middle-sized, and small, was determined by the Klimt drawing, when the Klimt drawing is no longer there, and we're just looking at the composite along with the signature, what kind of graphics might we construct upon that? What does the signature suggest? Does it suggest the figure, the lazy, lovely, quietly erotic figure of these two naked women embracing each other with their eyes closed? Probably not. So I want you to bear that question in mind. How could you arrive at a graphic composition from the composite and the signature if you didn't know the original graphics upon which the signature is based? And I don't know if we're jamming now. Are we jamming now? Perhaps not quite yet. But I propose to you that you consider taking these three terms and making them your own. What is the composite? It's just a group of dots on a sheet of paper with no particular order. What is the signature? It is the arrangement of some, but not all of those dots, according to dot-to-dot connections that suggest themselves when your mind looks at the composite. And then the graphics is a visualization or picture that would be added to the signature. Composite, signature, graphics. These are the three terms that you, as a apprentice celestician, need to learn and need to apply to make yourself comfortable in the realm of the constellations, in the realm of the real sky zodiac, the sky that you can observe. So I'm completing this introductory talk at this point, at the 1 hour mark. And I propose that you go directly to the talk on Quest for the Zodiac, which is the title of my book, to follow up directly with the material and the ideas that I've presented here.